Hello, this is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and welcome to Rolling Stone. We continue to read from the April 26 edition of the Rolling Stone magazine. And we start first with Random Notes, the third act, From Music to Medicine to The Pit. Ned Brower became an EMT after the band Rooney ended. His career comes full circle with a featured role in the ER. When Ned Brower sat down with The Pit producer and co-star Noah Wyle to discuss a big moment in season two, the world had not yet heard the name Alex Preti. All Brower knew at that point was that his character nurse, Jesse Van Horn, was to be arrested by ICE during an episode in which officers attempt to detain a patient in the fictional ED. A great part of the show is being able to touch on hot-button topics in a framework that's not always hitting the audience over the head, but that reflects society back from a hospital perspective, Ned Brower says of the pivotal moment in episode two of the HBO Max hit The Pit. The scene was filmed in November 2025, months before Preti, himself an ICU nurse, was gunned down by ICE agents in Minnesota while trying to assist a fellow protester. Says Brower, "It's been heartbreaking to see a great city like Minneapolis under siege." He says, "The kind of people who work as ICU nurses, it's just the best of the best." Brower would know. He's lived it. The acting musician's route to TV has been anything but straightforward. Medicine was always a part of Brower's life. He says, "I have a lot of doctors in my family, including his father, who was an ophthalmologist. But he was much more into skating and playing music in his hometown of Seattle." Brower says, "If my whole family got together to choose the last person that would probably go into medicine, I would have been the guy to win that award." After college, Brower went on to model and act in teen shows like Dawson's Creek and found fame as a drummer vocalist in Robert Schwartzman's rock band Rooney. When that band broke up around 2013, though, Brower found himself with bills to pay and limited options. Inspired by pals following a similar path, he became an EMT for the LA County Fire Department, then got his master's degree in 2020 at the UCLA School of Nursing. Despite his prior apathy about medicine, Brower was a natural, once sussing out that a 100-year grandmother accidentally ate her neighbor's weed brownies at her birthday bash. He prescribed that she listen to jazz music. Other experiences were less humorous. Brower still gets choked up recalling a teen who died during swim practice. Those trials, plus lessons gleaned working in the ED of a children's hospital in L.A., have been integral to his performance on the show The Pit. When season one ended with the aftermath of a mass shooter at a music festival, for example, Brower thought, "Can I apply those emotions that are somewhere in a box locked in my head to the show?" The Pit has also reawakened Brower's musical side. "On season one, I had a lot of downtime and my creative gears just went into high gear," Brower says. The result in his new electro-pop project, Blood Work, spelled W-E-R-K, get it, inspired by skate videos and 80s favorites like the Pet Shop Boys, the band, Brower and collaborator John Lowe, dropped two singles in March. They plan to sport hyper-realistic skull masks made with help from the Pit's effects team for an upcoming music video performance. Brower says, "My takeaway, being at the midpoint of life, is you just never know where things are going to lead. So I tend to say yes to everything and try new things." He adds, "There's been huge failures along the way, but sometimes the big failures that lead to something incredible that you never would have anticipated." Next in Random Notes, Level Up, Bad Guiles, G-Y-A-L, apostrophe S, Expensive Thrills. The Spanish singer emerged from the underground a cult favorite. Now she's taking a leap with a bold new album. Alba Ferrello, the Cotillion artist known as Bad Guile, was inspired by underground producers and late-night club vibes when she began releasing left-of-center mixtapes back in 2016. She says it was always about finding a type of energy, about linking up with people whose work you like, and later just letting things happen. She went on to say, as she cranked out viral hits with an abstract experimentalist like Florentino and El Gincho, she was guided by intuition, and it turned out there was a hungry fan base who loved what she was doing. They latched onto projects like Show Wine Mixtape and Worldwide Angel, eager to see more. Over the next few years, Farrell, age 29, became a mainstay on the festival circuit and a go-to collaborator across the Spanish language industry, working with megastars like Puerto Rican rapper Mikey Towers and Dominican party stalker Tuxia. In 2019, she clinched a deal with Interscope, and in 2024, she finally released her long-awaited debut album entitled La Joya, J-O-I-A, a project teeming with bright electronic and reggaeton sounds. But Farrell, a restless artist who describes herself as endlessly curious, that was just the beginning. Over the past 3 years, she's been hard at work on Mascara, an LP that feels like an elevated, expansive version of all the things she's been good at in the past. She landed on the name, which translates in English to more expensive, as she hammered out the first track, which is all about leveling up and taking a step forward. So much came from asking, who am I? What's the music that I love? What's the world I'm shaping? What are the codes and the language I'm building? She says. Her inquiry led to the album's wide-ranging production as it bounces from EDM beats to skittish morang to even compa, K-O-N-P-A, a smooth dance rhythm from Haiti. Farrell had been obsessed with the style and started testing it out on a song called Ultima Noche. As she was putting it together, she says she kept envisioning how the song might sound with Puerto Rican Dominican singer Ozuna. He didn't know where this style of music was from, but he fell in love, so I explained it to him, she says. He came to the studio at her invitation and helped bring the vision together. She calls the whole experience surreal. She says, I never thought I could make a song with Ozuna, and especially with something he didn't know and that he liked so much. Farrell understands that lots of people might not understand or accept her sonic wayfaring into other styles and cultures. She says she's had to engage those questions from the second she picked her artist name, a nod to the Caribbean genre that inspired her. I had to live through that in the beginning of my career, that conversation of, these cultures have been oppressed and they don't have the same history as you. It was a huge lesson, she adds, and it gave me a lot of consciousness. It made me learn a lot. Her approach, she says, has been from a place of respecting the music and loving it as a fan. She says she's been heartened that songs like Ultima Noche have been embraced by fans in Haiti, many of whom have posted their own cover versions online and sent her supportive messages. She's also been collaborating with artists from the country. Her next step is to get the album ready and start rehearsing major shows in Spain, where fans have been counting down. I feel like people are loving it, she says. But she's not thinking too much about what happens after. The whole album has brought her a new sense of confidence, she explains, and she feels like the journey itself is worth it. I don't know what's going to happen with this album, if it will go platinum, if it will or won't, or what the hell is going to happen, she says. I don't know, but the experiences this album has left me with being able to say, look, girl, how far you've come and what life has given you, is more than enough. And now we move from random notes to the Rolling Stone Q&A. James Blake, just trying to reflect the world as I see it through my own lenses. The British singer and producer explores our chaotic reality with his sixth album, The Softer Trying Times. James Blake is feeling back at home in London. He and longtime partner Jamil Jamil, made the move in 2025 after living in Los Angeles for 11 years, almost the amount of time that Blake, age 37, has been one of the music industry's most potent secret weapons, having worked with everyone from Beyonce to Bon Iver. He's in New York on a press run for his album entitled Trying Times, a collection that finds him at his most confident musically and offers an introspective view of the world we're in. Sonically, it glides between the sounds and instincts that have been present throughout Blake's career, from the brooding and expansive ballads of his 2013 breakout Overgrown to the ambient experimentation of the 2023's Playing Robots into Heaven. On the new album, UK rap heavyweight Dave offers a vibrant flow that affirms his countryman's current hot streak on Doesn't Just Happen, while the album's lead single, Death of Love, has a melodic groove of a velvety 80s pop hit. Blake's penchant for electronic soundscapes, meanwhile, has been subdued. He quips, "The process of production has veered so far into the automated, it almost feels rebellious to pick up a guitar." Now the Q&A. Question, so Trying Times, tell me about the process of making the album. Blake, it's been a few years in the making. Some of the tracks were started during the pandemic, actually. A lot's happened since then. I wrote it with a very small crew of people who are like my chosen musical family. Don Maker, Jamela, Bob McKenzie, Josh Smith. These people have been mainstays in my music writing for a long time, and yeah, I'm just trying to reflect the world as I see it through my own lens. Question, the title is striking. We are living in trying times. What inspired you to look in that direction? Blake? Trying times is quite an understatement. In England, if you're going through something truly hellish, you might say, trying times. So it's meant to be a little bit of an understatement, really. I think everyone will feel that way when they see that as a description. Question, I feel like your music is often quite romantic. It's interesting that you've got this song, Death of Love, that's the opposite of that. Blake, well, it's not a breakup song as much as it might seem like one. It was written at a time when I think online discourse was approaching maximum lack of empathy. I think people's desire to be seen was blocking their ability to see others. I think now we're starting to realize how much of it is bedrizen and algorithm-driven and how much of it is purposeful. I was reading a leaked email where somebody within their own company had basically sent this email saying, we want maximum engagement, we need maximum anger, we need maximum rage bait. And these are company directives, right? So how far back does that go? How much of what we've seen has been real? So Death of Love covers that idea. I don't know if I arrived at any answers. Question, you've been with Jamil Jamil for some years now. How does she help you creatively? Answer by Blake, she's the exec producer, but she's also producing on the tracks. There's sort of two kinds of different roles. So it's the same job description as the other producers on the record, basically, but in terms of arranging, referencing, bringing things to their fullest potential, that relationship started because she always had very impactful observations about songs where I was like, I don't know what to get it, how to get it there. And she would unlock things creatively, even back to the color in anything. To have that sort of acumen and knowledge to get you there is very special. So I feel lucky that that's my partner. Partner in life, but also in music. Question, have you thought about fatherhood at all, Blake? I don't crave it, to be honest. It's not a thought that enters my mind really ever. Somebody said to me once that people without a creative outlet have children, and that's their creative outlet. All I have is a creative outlet. So I guess that part of me is just sated, and I love my life as it is. Obviously, everyone should do what they want to do, but for me, I think I worry even in small ways and unconscious ways, accidentally, about the resentment I probably would feel for the lack of time I would have to do what I want to do. Question, Did you find yourself relearning instruments of techniques in real time on this record? Blake, I tend to learn by trying things rather than by studying. But when something requires it, I go, okay, let's give it a go. Just a little higher, the song, for example, is that. That end section where the strings go from this very euphonic primary colors, sweet harmony thing to this very chaotic, dramatic moment with some quite angular chord changes was one of my favorite moments on the record. It took a lot of work, but it was just so worth it. Question, this is also your sixth full-length album. Blake, fucking hell yeah. And the final question, how much stuff is left on the cutting room floor? Blake, if I think about it, I'll probably cry. There's at least three albums with people who are a few of my favorite artists of all time that haven't come out. And next we turn to the feature in this month's magazine called The Future of Music. Meet the artists who have us most excited about the sounds of tomorrow. The Future 25, Fuiza Regido, reader's note, the group's name is spelled Fuerza Regida. The members of the homegrown Música Mexicana band started out playing backyard gigs in San Bernardino. Their stadium-sized ambitions have made them the voice of a new generation. It's early one evening in January, and the massive compound that houses Street Mob Records, the rising musical label in Rancho Cucamonga, California, is back in action. Everyone has returned from the holidays, and the industrial building has morphed into a busy command center. In one area, six men are building a Sabato Gigante-inspired set for an upcoming video shoot. In a smaller conference room, label managers are scarfing down meals from El Pollo Loco between meetings. One section is packed with luxury cars. There are several Rolls Royces, a 2021 Lamborghini SVJ, a Chevy Camaro SS, an old-school Chevy 454 SS. They all belong to Jesus Ortiz Paz, the frontman of the Música Mexica band Fuerza Regida, and the founder of Street Mob Records, and he just walked through the door. As soon as Paz, better known as J.O.P., swaggers into the building, the members of Fuerza Regida take their seats around a boardroom table like Power Rangers gathered before a mission. We're only days into the new year, but they have a wildly ambitious agenda. Deliver an innovative 11th album, expand Street Mob Records, and sell out a summer stadium tour. J.O.P. sits at the head. He's cocksure, charming, and the band's center of gravity. Even with a lingering cold, he does most of the talking, pausing only to reach for some tissues. To his right sits Moises Lopez, the Tolo Choki player, the youngest, newest, and even the band will admit, the cutest member. Next to him is guitarist Christian Ramos, focused and business-minded, balancing band duties with outside ventures that include a successful seafood business. Then there's Samuel Jaimez, the quiet homeboy who warns me that he's bad at answering questions. And finally, Jose Pilon Garcia, the sousaphone and tuba player, the goofball who is quick with a joke and gets along with everyone. In the decades since forming, Fuerza Regida have pushed their corridors from backyard carne asadas to arena stages, becoming the vanguard of a wave of Música Mexicana acts that have redefined the genre's look, sound, and commercial ceiling in the streaming era. They fused traditional acoustic instrumentation with hip-hop swagger and internet-age marketing. In doing so, they've turned a once traditional sound into a generational movement made by and for young Mexican-Americans raised between cultures and fluent in both. Yes, we're trendsetters, J.O.P. says. He says, I'm not going to say we do everything first, but sometimes other people will do it first. But what we make sure we do is that we do it better. Last year, their album, spelled IIXPANTIA, debuted at number 2 on the Billboard 200, making it the highest charting Spanish language album by a duo or group. Mi Halo, their collaboration with Grupo Frontera, earned a Latin Grammy nomination for Best Regional Song a few months later, followed by a Grammy nod in the Best Música Mexicana album category for their album Mala Mia. With those accomplishments in the rear view, the stakes are higher than ever. Their next album has to hit harder than the last. Their growing Street Mob Records roster depends on their vision for the label, and a gigantic tour leaves no room for mistakes. I got the biggest pressure on my back making sure we sell this out, JOP tells me later. But I don't worry, I'd be doing it if I knew I could. I wouldn't be doing it if I knew I couldn't. Yet for all the talk of global impact, the guys are still anchored by their hometown in the Inland Empire, the IE for locals. The stretch of SoCal, 2 hours east of LA, dotted with warehouse districts and massive parking lots. They joke about the trek from the city, and one of their managers recommends a taco truck down the road where all the boys ate a few weeks before. The guys' families are here too, close enough to drop by. At one point during the conversation, JOP's phone rings. It's his mom. She, in Spanish, asks on the speaker, "Do you want just the chicken soup or the salsa too?" JOP might be one of the biggest stars in Mexican music, but he's still her son, and he's sick after all. "Send me it all," JLP says, instructing one of his guys to go pick the food up. "Chili, avocado, I'll call you later. I'm in a meeting. La quiero mucho." "I love you too," she replies. He immediately snaps back to business. That combination of down-home tradition and larger-than-life ambition makes Fuerza Regida the type of band young Mexican boys idolize. Like many of their fans, each member was born to immigrant parents who settled in Southern California chasing something better. Jaimez worked at a car wash. JOP cut hair as a barber. Garcia grew up on a ranch. Lopez was an LA Galaxy ball boy. They still remember their early days, staying in shitty motels before gigs and eating McDonald's. Their tour bus was so janky at the time it didn't have AC. Laughs Jaimez, "We would put our heads in the ice chest. We would take turns. And it fucking stank, bro. Their fucking didn't shower," adds JOP, referring to his bandmates. "We shared the bus on the fucking 20 hours to Texas." Back then, touring on a busted bus was the dream. The opportunity of a lifetime, JOP calls it. Fucking sleeping in a hotel in a different state was already doing it, even though we were fucking getting paid $1,800 a show. These days, the reality looks much different. At one point, one of the band's homies pulls up to headquarters in a brand new Ferrari Purosangue, the car maker's only SUV. JOP takes it for a speed drive down the street. "Yeah, I think I'm gonna buy that one," he says, like it's a sandwich at a deli. The sticker price is almost $500,000. It will be one more piece of an ever-growing empire. About an hour into our conversation, JOP slaps a small vial onto the conference table. "You can put that in there, bro," he tells me, pointing to my recorder. JOP loves peptides. Today, he's taking thiomycin alpha-I, which is meant to boost his immune system and help his body fight off a cold that he has. He already did a vitamin IV drip yesterday, but these are supposed to help too, he says. He talks about how he takes NADs, a coenzyme used for cellular regeneration and anti-aging, and how he and the boys have been tracking their macros, cutting out sugar from their diets, and exercising regularly. JOP grabs his peptide syringe, holding it up to the light to make sure he's taking it in the right amount. "Peptides is a new future," JOP says matter-of-factly. "All this, your body makes it. This is just synthetically made. It's like a lab diamond. You enhance the body." JOP talks the same way about the band's music. constantly finding ways to evolve and enhance it as much as possible. The Furious Genesis story started with just the two guitarists, Ramos and James, who met in 2013 at a martial arts gym. Ramos's cousin would step in on vocals. They had a tiny repertoire, the birthday song La Maniditas, Ariel Camacho's A Queda Roto, and maybe two other corridos they knew how to play. At the time, JOP had just left another band. Through a mutual friend, he heard Ramos and James were looking for a bass player. He came to a practice and was offered a spot almost immediately. Before long, he assumed the role of lead vocalist while still playing bass, juggling both roles at once. They've been calling themselves Grupo Ramis, a mashup of Ramos's and James's last names. When it got serious after a couple of gigs of us charging $60 an hour, I told them, hey, we should change the name because I don't feel like it's part of my shit, JOP remembers. The conversation marked a shift, less hobby, more real. Eventually, they changed their name to Furiosa Regida, which loosely translates to something like the force that rules. The band also liked that it was different from the many Musica Mexicana acts that started with the word grupo. One of Furiosa's first gigs as a three-piece, the one where they met Garcia, was almost ruined because of a breakup. Ramos had gotten dumped over text. And while at a house party, he decided to leave minutes before the performance to see if he could catch his ex with another guy. I got really hot because this fool just left our first jam ever, JOP says, laughing. I was talking shit the whole way back, remember? By then, Furiosa had started getting buzz locally after recording a cover of a lesser-known corrido called Uno Personal. The laid-back song is a celebration of the simple things. Wanting a well-rolled joint, a cold six-pack, and not caring what anyone else thinks. In the 909, it quickly caught fire. They posted it to YouTube in 2017, and they say the video surpassed 100,000 views in less than a month. For us, that was crazy. Everybody in the IE knew about us already, the IE being the Inland Empire, says JOP. They didn't know who the fuck it was, but they heard the song. As the band gained local recognition, Ramos and JOP got temporary warehouse jobs to supplement their income. Garcia was working construction with benefits and everything, but eventually was faced with leaving his odd job or leaving the band. Recalls Garcia, I had a kid already and a kid on the way. I got hit out of nowhere, bro. He says, imagine fucking making $2,500 a week in construction, health insurance, fucking dental, everything. Plan B is making sure Plan A works, Ramos says. That's kind of what it was. The group broke through on a national level in 2018 with Radicamos en Nos Centro, a corrido detailing the hustle of a L.A. dealer. The song's success led them to a recording contract. The band signed a dual deal with Lumbre Music, an indie founded by the band Legado 7 and Rancho Humilde, the pioneering label led by Mexican music entrepreneur Jimmy Humilde. Smaller acts like Los Alegres del Barranco, Arsenal Efectivo, and Alto Casino were already generating buzz in Mexican music. But with Furiosa Regida in the ranks, Rancho Humilde quickly became one of the defining labels of the movement, touting other heavy hitters who joined the roster, like Herencia de Patrones, Nathaniel Cano, and Junior H. The group looks back at the signing with conflicting feelings. Furiosa Regida and Rancho Humilde are currently in a legal battle involving allegations of withheld royalties and financial mismanagement. Rancho first sued the band for a breach of contract. JOP avoids going into specifics, but emphasizes that artists should go into record deals with a manager and a lawyer. That's a big thing I can't really talk about because I've got an ongoing lawsuit, JOP says. At the end of the day, who's ever in the right will prevail. I don't stress out about that stuff. What the band acknowledges is that Rancho brought them visibility and a much broader reach. The group joined the label's now legendary Smoke Me Out tours, which mobilized a new generation of Poco Mexican-American fans. That is, U.S.-born kids raised on both corridos and hip-hop across California, Arizona, and Texas, and introducing acts like Ferrezo to an audience already into the new sound. The momentum from the Smoke Me Out runs grew so much that they went from being a high-billed act on a multi-artist tour to the main event. By 2022, the band was 7 studio albums and selling out large venues across much of the United States. They were the face of a movement and the architects of its next phase. With that visibility also became a clearer sense of who they were. Like their sound, the Ferrezo image has transformed over the years. When they started, the original 4 members would tour wearing the coordinated rhinestone-heavy outfits long associated with regional Mexican groups. But as their music's reach expanded, so did the ways they leaned more into the rap culture of Southern California that raised them. Today, the band moves in diamond-studded designer wear. J.O.P. is often seated in the front row at a Paris Fashion Week, and he even performed a corrido at a recent Kid Super runway show. Travel by private jet is the new normal, so much that their pilot once reached out to me to write a story about him. At one point during the interview, the conversation swerves into a 5-minute debate about hair. The Ferrezo Regida guys have been growing theirs out. They roast each other over who's actually committed to the look and who's secretly trimming the sides. Long hair, facial hair, fucking rock star shit, J.O.P. explains. We're probably going to be like the Beatles. Note, the reference isn't new. Back in 2019, they recreated the Abbey Road cover, crossing a street in San Bernardino for the cover of Del Barra Hasta Aquí. The band's image changes have also included the addition of a member, Moises Lopez, the group's youngest member by several years. He officially joined the band when Ferrezo released the pair of Pa' Que Hablan albums at the end of 2022 and has since become a central presence for the band. There's a video of Lopez at about age 14 jamming along with Ferrezo at a sushi spot. He was a little kid, bro, Ramos says after Lopez finds the video in his Snapchat memories. First, he joined the group's backing band to play bass on Vamos Bien from the 2020s Arturo Pedro Otro Mundo, but he needed to learn Tolochuchi, the upright bass-like instrument central to many Ferrezo songs. Little by little, Lopez started to get noticed by fans. I didn't believe it. I'm a Ferrezo Regida guy, like, fuck, he says. I was filled with emotion. For the first couple of months, Lopez kept his head down, but over time, he's become like a mini J.O.P., listening to arrangements and demo pitches, often narrowing down what reaches the front man. I know what he likes, Lopez says. Adding this dude, we knew we were going to get more young girls to be our fans, J.O.P. says bluntly. Imagine this too, Ramos was losing weight a little bit, but you see my boys over here, we're all fat and getting older. Now he's the one with all the motion, all the maritas, Garcia jokes, all the girls. In February, just before Valentine's Day, Ferrezo Regida officially announced the This Is Our Dream tour. To celebrate, the guys have all upgraded their wheels and are posting videos on Instagram showing street mob headquarters looking more like a luxury dealership. In one photo, Jaimez pulls up in a white Rolls Royce Cullen. Shout out to the ones who dragged me out of that car wash, he captioned on an Instagram post. Life is good. Lopez steps out of a Ferrari 488, a gift that coincides with his 22nd birthday. Garcia parks his Batmobile-like Lamborghini Hurricane, while Ramos sports his new Lamborghini Urus. They're excited to get back on the road and also to kickstart their biggest live effort. Their label, Street Mob, took off during the pandemic when touring stalled. JOP launched it with COO Christian Toro Pramia and CFO Luis Lopez, and what began as a makeshift operation out of someone's house has since grown into a full-fledged enterprise. 18 artists, more than 30 songwriters, many of whom composed for Farisa, and dozens of employees working out of their sprawling warehouse. Since I'm an artist, I try to see the best for the artist, JOP says. Sometimes my own team tells me I'm too nice because I put myself in the artist's shoes. The thing I'm fixing is making sure they see everything. A lot of companies aren't transparent. Among Street Mob's signees, Chino Pacas, the youthful star with a gravelly voice who drank Drake, once asked to write a corrido for him. Clave Especial, who delivered one of 2025's strongest corridos albums with Mia Note Astices. Kyle 24, longtime Street Mob signees, who teamed up with Farisa on the massive hit Que Onada, and newcomers like Linea Personnel, Angel Tombado, and Mal XO. Street Mob also hosts Don't Fall in Love Fest in San Bernardino, which has included lineups that blend heavy-hitting Mexican acts like Banda MS and Las Katanas de Tijuana, and rap stars like Future and Lil Baby. Our culture is about putting our own kind on, says Primera. Street Mob is a platform where people can come up with their dream. It's a family-oriented, independent record label. We know what it's like to build an artist from the ground up. Long before his COO title, Primera did whatever Farisa needed. He was an assistant equipment manager, driver. He had hauled the guys from gig to gig. His paycheck ranged from maybe $150 to $200 a show, if the night went well. But he stayed. Loyalty got me here. Loyalty and believing in his dreams more than anything, he says, referring to JOP. Street Mob has also allowed the band to expand its philanthropic arm, offering a hand to survivors of the fires that affected the LA era in early 2025 and victims of ICE raids last summer. The band donated funds to the Immigrant Defenders Law Center to help cover legal fees for individuals. The talk sparks a thought in JOP's head. Imagine if I run for president when I'm 38. Right now, it's 30% Hispanic in the U.S. Imagine in 10 years' time, he says. You usually start out as a mayor somewhere. Well, we move on from Farisa Regida to the next artist spotlighted in the Future of Music feature in this month's Rolling Stone magazine. And that artist is TWS. Meet the rising K-pop group with retro vibes, a feel-good pop sound, tons of energy, and a mega hit about young love. TWS, pronounced to us, are one of the most exciting and energetic young K-pop groups today. They've won praise for their music, stage presence, and their model-like visuals. But they don't take it for granted that anyone knows who they are, which is why when they log on to Zoom around lunchtime in Seoul, South Korea, to chat with Rolling Stone magazine, Shinyu Duhon, Younghae Hanjin, Jihoon, and Kingmin pepper their conversations with descriptors. Kingmin, age 18, introduces himself as the group's maekni, or youngest, while several other members point out that Shinyu, age 22, is TWS's leader, as well as the eldest in the group. Since debuting in January 2024 with their mini-album Sparkling Blue, the six-piece group has embraced a feel-good sound that leans into retro vibes, lush harmonies, and clever wordplay. People have told us that they are reminded of their own youth when they listen to some of our songs, Youngjae says. On their viral hit single Overdrive, 17 million YouTube views and counting, they capture the newness of infatuation. Bolstered by fuzzy electric guitars, the song also provides the perfect moment for Tuas to show off their AEGYO, a quintessentially South Korean gesture of acting adorable that doesn't always translate well overseas. For their version, Tuas added an endearing shoulder shake to the choreography that enticed a slew of A-list Korean celebrities to imitate them. We were hoping it would blow up, Duhon says, but it didn't really sink in until we saw all the singers and actors dancing along on awards shows. Now they're looking forward to showing the world what else they can do. We have packed in many memories since our debut 2 years ago, King Min adds, and we have many stories to tell through our songs. And the next artist spotlighted in the future of music is Tyler Ballgame, a songwriter from New England with an unforgettable voice. Tyler Perry's life-changing moniker all started at a bar. I created Tyler Ballgame to play a show at the Fable, he says, referring to the tavern in LA's Eagle Rock neighborhood that became the center of his scene in the early 2020s. We'd all go to each other's shows. That was a big part of building the myth around Tyler Ballgame. Mythology and community are two concepts that come up quite a bit in conversation with the 34-year-old singer, who's, for the first time again, is one of 2026's busiest independent debuts. It's yielded a genuine indie rock hit, I Believe in Love, an opening slot for Alabama Shakes, and even a DM from his hero, Fleet Foxes. Robin Pecknold, growing up in Rhode Island, he took to a musical theater and chorus and formed a Fleet Foxes cover band shortly after high school, but fell into a prolonged period of depression. I was consigned to make this talented person, I was consigned to being this talented person who was never going to make it, he says. Then he realized he could engage in a time-honored American tradition. He could become someone else in California, borrowing part of the nickname for a New England legend, Red Sox great Ted Williams. Perry fled his home for L.A. and rediscovered his operatic, full-bodied voice, which has gotten lots of vocal comparisons to Roy Orbison. Tyler Ballgame is a character, he says by way of explanation. He says it's a mask. Anyone can be their idol if they wear the mask. And we move the spotlight to the next artist, Aubrey Hobart. The co-writer of That's So True hits a sweet spot of honesty and humor with her solo work. Much has been said about Aubrey Hobart's music since she showed up on the scene less than 2 years ago. It's self-referential, confessional, stream of consciousness relatable. And she told her to come up story enough times to have the Spark Notes version down pat. As a child, Aubrey Hobart loved pop music and was a dancer. In high school, she decided that being a writer was actually cooler. So she studied dramatic writing at NYU Tisch, graduated, started working at a staff writing job at Nickelodeon, and moved in with a childhood friend. It just so happened to be Gracie Abrams. Maybe you've heard of her. They ended up co-writing songs like Abrams' most streamed single, That's So True, which has 1.6 billion and counting on Spotify. That song has Hobart's fingerprints all over it, a fast-strung guitar, lyrics falling out at a breakneck pace, a sense of heartbreak and confusion mingled with self-aware humor. Hobart expanded on that sound to great effect with solo hits like Sue Me and Thirst Trap. Now she's excited to get writing again. I do not feel beholden to making four more Sue Me's and six more Thirst Traps or whatever, Aubrey Hobart says. Whatever it is I'm going to make next time, I know that my melodic and my structural sensibilities live so deeply in pop that whatever I want to say, hopefully it works. And now we move on to the artist, Tu Hollis. His maximalist synth-pop rage rap hybrid, gets fans moving. Two Hollis, the 22-year-old rapper and producer whose whirlwind 2025 included everything from a world tour to Nepo baby allegations, says his major label debut album, Star, did everything he felt it should. It scratched the itch I had for making a more minimal, self-reflecting pop album, he says. It was also a handy introduction to Two Hollis's maximalist approach to production, with sharp synths cutting through explosives 808s. For a lot of my projects, the production sometimes felt like the main point, and the vocals came second, he says. But this next stuff I'm working on, I'm really working a lot more on the vocals and the songwriting of it. He says he's gone social media free and has been reading and watching movies to take in influences outside of music. His parents, for whatever it's worth, are a prominent music publicist and a founding member of the avant-garde group Tortoise. One thing I'm really inspired by right now is storytelling in a song, he adds. I feel like, at least in the current scene, I don't feel like people are trying that too much, or at least I'm not seeing it in the way I want to see it. And next, we move the spotlight in the future of music to the artist Ink. She's collaborated with Beyoncé and Kendrick Lamar and now has her eye on Nashville. When Ink, decked out in a furry vest and a large turquoise bolo tie, walked through the door of Rolling Stone's studio to record a recent appearance on the Nashville Now podcast, she realized she had forgotten one important piece of her outfit, her cowboy hat. But Ink, born Atiya Boggs to a military mom in Germany and raised in Georgia, is nothing if not resourceful. Spying an old felt hat hanging on the wall as decor, she tossed it atop her head and made it her own. I inked it up, she says. The 39-year-old songwriter, who's also a singer, musician, and producer, has established herself as a secret weapon collaborator across genres. At this year's Grammy Awards, she was nominated for her work on Kendrick Lamar's GNX, and during the 2025 awards, she watched with delight as Beyoncé's Cowboy Carter, for which she co-wrote hits like Texas Hold'em, was named Album of the Year. As other artists helped position me and help put my music out there through their music, it helps, Ink says. It really don't matter what genre, the topic, the subject, it's just about the music. Now she's focusing on Nashville. Last fall, she released her EP, Big Buskin, a nod to her early days playing for change around Atlanta. She's currently writing a full country album. So many people worry about what is and what isn't country. We worry about labels and forget about the substance, the real thing, she says. People from all walks of life are loving this genre. I stand with good music. It doesn't matter where you're from, what you're doing, what you own, as long as you represent it right. To that end, Ink says she's inspired by country artists like Sturgill Simpson and the late Charlie Pride, as well as Casey Musgraves, with whom she's written several songs, and Kane Brown. She's not adverse to Billy Ray Cyrus either. I still listen to Achy Breaky Heart, Ink shares. I just listen to what feels good. And she's ultimately unbothered by anyone who might second-guess her latest choice of genre. If it ain't country, she adds, I don't know what it is. And we leave the future of music spotlight on artists to the Rolling Stone interview. Elisa Lou, now that I have control, I want to show it. First there were the press conferences, then there were the parties. Turns out, the first time figure skater Elisa Lou got a proper sleep after winning Olympic gold was on her flight home from Milan, Italy, a few days later. We got upgraded because they were like, we can't put you in the back of the plane, she says. So shout out to those Delta flight attendants. Since then, Elisa Lou has been getting used to a hero's welcome. From the Oakland Creamery that offered her ice cream for life, to the paparazzi who followed her car after a Today Show appearance. America loves a sweetheart, and we love a winner even more. But Elisa Lou has captivated the country with more than just her skill and charm. At age 13, she was the youngest person ever to win the women's national championship. Only 4'7" at the time, she famously had to be helped up onto the podium. At age 16, she placed sixth at the Beijing Olympics, earned bronze at the World Championships, and then abruptly quit the sport in a post on Instagram. Her return to figure skating 2 years later was more than just an incredible comeback. 9 months after resuming training, she was named world champion. It was a testament to the power of finding success on one's own terms. With her halo hair, her smiley piercing, and her vibey performances to Lady Gaga and Lofi, Lou is no ice princess. She eats what she wants, wears what she wants, skates how she wants, and looks like she's having a ball doing it. "That's what I'm fucking talking about," she shouted after her medal-clinching free skate in Milan. "My goal was to do amazing programs," she says. "And the moment I finished my free skate and also the gala program, that's when I was like, yeah, my goal is complete." And now the Rolling Stone interview with Elisa Lou. Question: how did you start skating, Elisa? "I was 5 years old and my dad took me and my sister Selena to the rink, and I really liked it. I loved to fall. I loved to go as fast as I could. It gave me a roller coaster feeling. I picked it up really fast, so my dad put me in group lessons, and that turned into private lessons, and then I became competitive." Question: when did your life start to look different from the average kid's? Elisa: from sixth grade on, I was homeschooled and I hated it. I have ADHD, so I do not do well learning like that. It was a struggle. Question: when you were age 13, you won nationals, but you don't have a lot of memories from that time. Elisa: yeah, I block them out. Every time I see a clip of it, it's like I'm watching a movie. I know that's me, but it's like I'm seeing what everyone else is seeing. Question: why do you think that is, Elisa? Probably because that time in my life was so bad. I just didn't want to remember it. Practice was so serious. I would cry after falling on every jump. The team I had around me was so strict. I was in fight or flight mode all the time. I didn't enjoy being at the rink from 7 in the morning to 7 at night every day. But I skated every day because I was scared that I would lose all my jumps and lose my abilities if I took a day off. And since every day was the same, I can't recall certain years or stuff like that. I miss birthdays and holidays, so that also makes the timeline a little bit sketchy for me. There's no pinpoints. Question: that sounds really hard, Elisa. It was, and I was living alone, too, for a long time, from age 14 to 16. I lived in the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs, Colorado, and I trained at the nearby Broadmoor facility. I was just Ubering from the OTC to the rink, back and forth every day. That's it. And it was COVID, so I was there by myself. Question: you didn't even see your coaches? Elisa: no, they were at their houses, and I was just skating by myself. That was my life, yeah, so it's not ideal. Question: when you trained away from your home and your family, how did you choose where you were going? Elisa: I didn't pick where I was going. They just sent me off to certain facilities where they thought, oh, these coaches are great. This environment will be good for you. It will make you a better skater. Question: when you say they, who was making these decisions? Elisa: I have no idea. Question: I presume your dad was involved. Elisa: he was definitely involved in it. And I don't know who else, probably higher-ups in the U.S. Skating Federation. Question: I heard you say competition is meaningless. What do you mean? Elisa: well, my last skating career, all the programs I did, I didn't like. They weren't my ideas. I never made a single decision. I was put in dresses and hair and makeup that I wasn't comfortable in. It wasn't me. I didn't know who I was at that point, to be fair, and I didn't like to perform because I was embarrassed to show my programs. Now that I have control, I want to show it. I want to feel more confident. Question: You graduated high school at age 15 because your coaches wanted you to do Olympics prep for a full year. Elisa, yeah, and I didn't want to let anybody down. But when COVID hit, I didn't care anymore. I was really just doing it for my younger self because I knew I wanted to go to the Olympics when I was a little kid. So I was going to hold out for her and then be done. I had my plan. I'm just going to go to the Olympics and then quit. And that's what I did. Question, so you walked away from the sport at age 16. What did you do? Elisa, I got my driver's license so I was more free. I could go wherever I wanted, hang out with my friends, take my siblings out. That helped me feel like my own person. And then I went on vacation for the first time, family vacation with my best friend's family. We were just at the beach for a week, swimming a ton. I went to school, started UCLA. I went skiing for the first time. Question, skiing led you back to skating? Lisa, it was in 2024, January. I'd never been skiing and I loved it so much. It's so similar to skating. You're cold, you're gliding, you're going fast, and the adrenaline rush I felt was like anything else I'd ever quit. I had to do it more often. But the mountains are far from where I live, and the ice rink is right there. So that week, I went to the rink with my best friend and stepped on for an hour, and it was a lot of fun. Then a couple of weeks later, I went again, and I was like, oh, this is even more fun. My goal was to go once a week, and that's when summer hit. I was like, I'm going to skate a couple of times a week. Question, you were scratching an itch? Elisa, yeah, I was like, I need to find a way to satisfy this urge to go fast. But it was really traumatizing to go back to the rink. I had to go with my best friend, otherwise I would never have tried it again. Question, how long until you started to feel like you were skating at a pre-retirement level? Elisa, definitely months. But I was already better in some ways. My artistry was better because I was more in my body. I would say after less than a year, I was back. Question, well, after less than a year, you won the world championship. Elisa, yeah, crazy. Question, tell me about telling your coach that you wanted to return to competition. Elisa, it was February 21st, 2024. I called him like, I just want lessons. Let's see where this takes us. Question, and his response was, Elisa, he said no. And then I had to convince him. He was like, before you didn't like doing this, what about now? I'm like, well, I'm just not going to do that. I want to pick my own music. I had music ideas, dress ideas that I wanted to put on into the world. Question, your dad was really invested in your career before you retired. I read that he would show up at the rink with a radar gun to test the speed of your jumps. Elisa, he did. Question, what was her response when you decided to come back? Elisa, I have no idea. He was happy, but that didn't matter to me. I was almost mad that he was happy, like, how dare you? Question, what do you mean? Elisa, well, I was just like, you don't deserve to be happy over this decision because you were mad when I quit. I thought he shouldn't have an opinion on it, if that makes sense. I didn't want him to care it at all because it shouldn't affect him as much as it did the last time. Question, in some ways, he must have known that you're going to carve your own path because, Elisa, he raised me that way. Question, exactly. Can you talk about your dad's background? He helped coordinate your demonstrations around the time of the Tiananmen Square protests in 1989, and then he had to flee, right? Elisa, yeah, he was a student protester in China, and he immigrated here and built his life. He led everything to start fresh again. So he's really brave, and he breaks a lot of social norms, and he raised us to be independent. We would take public transit trains as kids all the time. He wasn't there a lot because he'd be at work. Our family has 5 kids. That's a lot of kids to take care of, so he had to work in the office all day long to provide for us financially. Well, that wraps up the interview of Elisa Liu. This has been Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'll be back with you next week for the next edition of Rolling Stone. Thank you so much for listening.